Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. While the Islamic State no longer holds territory, it still has the capacity to recruit and to engage in terrorist actions. On this week's episode, we'll consider the future of ISIS, along with the fate of thousands of captured fighters and their families. Joining us for this conversation is Ali Soufan. He's a former FBI special agent, and he's the author of The Autonomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. He's joined by Robin Wright. She's a writer for The New Yorker and fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This program is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
ISIS lost its last territory in Syria on March 23rd. And when that happened, more than 5,000 fighters were captured or surrendered. Tens of thousands more were already in some form of captivity or restraint. Thousands of civilians came along. Robin Wright, what's the latest on ISIS in captivity? Where are they? Do we know how many there are?
The Syrian Democratic Forces that led the fight against ISIS captured more than 9,000 fighters. About 2,000 of them are foreign fighters. The majority are Syrians and Iraqis. But among those 2,000 who are believed to be among the most militant, you have dozens of nationalities, including the United States, but also from Russia, China, France, Morocco, Egypt. I toured the prison, which is now one of these pop-up prisons that is now holding many of the prisoners. They filled one prison in 4 days with 1,500. And these are all facilities that had to be organized really at the last minute because no one estimated how many there would be. But on top of those fighters, there are another 73,000, largely women and children, who were the families of ISIS fighters. And they are now being confined in a camp in northeast Syria in a city called Al-Hol. And the conditions there are pretty miserable. Again, no one anticipated, whether it was the American intelligence community, the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the international aid groups, what kind of numbers there would be and what their needs would be. These are people who are now totally dependent for housing, for food, for blankets, and for medical care, everything including, you know, measles vaccines.
Do they share with the fighters themselves an international profile, these women?
Well, it's interesting. The women had four female battalions within ISIS, and some of the other women who lived under the Islamic State contend that these women were often among the most brutal in their enforcement of social and cultural and legal restrictions on people who lived under ISIS command. And it's quite interesting at Al-Hol, there are women, particularly in the annex for the foreign fighters, who are trying to recreate the caliphate, in effect. They are trying to impose strict Islamic rule and even stoning some of the women who engage with, whether it's foreign reporters or male aid workers.
It's ISIS. It's just ISIS in jail now. Ali Soufan, does this make for a complicated months ahead, perhaps even years ahead, as I'm bound to say that a lot of these countries are not going to want their nationals back or will all do so only if they immediately imprison them when they arrive or will never take them back?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what Robin talked about is a problem waiting to happen. This is the cyclical nature of terrorism. You know, in Al-Hol, for example, you have almost 74,000. Granted, many of them, about 42 from Syria, I believe, and 43% from Iraq. But there's also the foreigners who are from third country. And I think what we're seeing now that the caliphate might be physically defeated, but spiritually, mentally, it's still there. And ISIS will probably take advantage of the situation in these camps in order to make these people living martyrs. We have to think about the local people from Iraq and Syria. They are important to the social fabric of Iraq and Syria. And remember, ISIS happened in the first place because of the policies of the Maliki government in Iraq against the Sunnis, which ISIS benefited from directly in establishing their so-called state and so-called caliphate. And we're seeing these dynamics continue to exist. As for the foreigners, we have about 5,000 from Europe who went to join Iraq and Syria, ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Granted, there is less of them who stayed. Many came back. About the average 20 to 25% came back to the to their nations. But the people who are the foreign fighters who Robin spoke about, and especially some of the women and the children, are still there. And this is going to be a big problem. What do you do with them? The European need to basically take care of their citizens. I think every country need to take care of their citizen. I know it is politically complicated. It's operationally complicated. There is a significant political and financial cost for this to happen. However, the cost is going to be way more down the road if they let these people stay there, or the Kurds or the Iraqis or whoever release them. Now they are all in one place. We can control the situation. We can interview these people. We can figure out who did what. They can do a lot of prosecutions for people who are involved in criminal activities. They can do rehabilitations for others. If you let these people go, I think they're going to be spread around the world, and it's going to be extremely difficult to surveil them and counter the threat that they might pose down the road. Let me put it to you this way. We had that before with the Soviet Afghan jihadis, people who went to fight in Afghanistan against the Soviets. Many of them could not go back home, especially from Egypt, from Libya, from Algeria. They created a subculture, and they went around this guy, Osama bin Laden, and they established Al-Qaeda. Some European countries think maybe we can pull their citizenship away. Yeah, that's a very short-sighted decision, because those people have family and friends back home, and that can radicalize further people in these communities. Saudi Arabia took the citizenship of Osama bin Laden alone. That did not stop the East Africa embassy bombing, did not stop the USS Cole, and did not stop 9/11 that changed the world. I think every country need to be responsible towards their citizen. They need to send investigation teams, intelligence teams, do interviews of these individuals and figure out who they can flip because they want to cooperate to go back home. Who can they testify against others who are so radical that they need to be prosecuted and so forth. But it's either we pay now or we're going to pay later. And it's what we've seen with Afghanistan back in the late 80s, early 90s, but on steroids with ISIS.
But Ali, briefly, just in ones and twos, these people have created a challenge for different countries. In Britain, the story of a woman trying to get back into the country and reunite with her family has become a national issue, debated from one end of the country to the other, debated in Parliament. Can you imagine that at scale? Countries trying to take home not just one person, but three dozen, each with their own need to be debriefed, to be examined, to be analyzed, to see whether they could really enter society again. Is it really plausible?
Look, you know, what you're saying is very, very important point, and this is probably one of the difficulties many European countries have, especially because they don't have the laws of conspiracy to deal with the situation. However, This is because of the lack of strategy. There is no strategy from the Europeans in dealing with this situation. You have in England, for example, 400 who came back already, more than 400 who came back already. And there is no strategy to deal with these individuals. And guess what? Most of these people are free. Most of these people are roaming around. So they need to develop a strategy on how to deal with the situation. And unfortunately, that does not exist. Look, if Kazakhstan can develop a strategy to take their citizens back. Russia can develop a strategy to take their citizens back. Morocco and so many other countries. I think the European countries can figure out a way to do it. However, I think it's very difficult politically. And as I mentioned earlier, either they're going to have to deal with this now when they have almost total control of the situation, or they're going to have to deal with it later. I mean, they can't keep them with the Kurds. The Kurds is not a country. I think there's a lot of complications in dealing with the Kurds, in continuing to hold these fighters. The Iraqi government, they are prosecuting them, and that's good. But every time there's a European that received this death sentence because what they did in Iraq and Syria, the European countries, they go up in arm. Oh, how dare you do the death sentence? So look, if you want to leave them there, they have to be subjected to the laws of the countries where they are. So I think the Europeans need to develop a strategy, because if they don't, many of these people will be released. A lot of them will go and join ISIS in different areas around the world where ISIS is still operating, Southeast Asia, Africa. There are so many different places where ISIS capitalizes on local conflict in order to embed themselves in the region, and they can fight there, or they might sneak into Europe or try to recruit family and friends in Europe based on the status of living martyrs that has been created. We've seen that before. Let's learn from the past.
Robin Wright, you've visited with some of the fighters who are arguably in some sort of rehabilitation process. What did they tell you? Were any of them ready to denounce the struggle as the price to get their ticket punched for a re-entry into another country, to get themselves out of prison?
Look, the rehabilitation program is one tiny little fraction of the way Syrian Democratic Forces and the international community is dealing with the numbers. It applies only to the Syrians, and only to those who were not fighters within ISIS, but those who were, you know, the functionaries, the labor, who, whether they were janitors or cooks or whatever, but those who may have had guns, but they weren't involved in fighting and killing, that had committed no felonies. A very small number of them have been given back to the tribes to go through a rehabilitation program. And though I did interview both the leader, the sheikh who runs the one of the pilot programs, and some of the recent graduates. But let me address some of the points Ali made. First of all, the autocratic countries that don't have kind of rule of law or have questionable justice systems are most willing to take back their fighters because they can detain them indefinitely and they don't necessarily have to have the kind of evidence you would in a Western court to prove their guilt. One of the problems is that there is very little independent documentation on what each individual fighter has done. You can't rely on other ISIS fighters to be the sole source of information. They would be questioned in court. And so the Europeans have taken a number of different actions. The Brits have stripped citizenship of some of the ISIS fighters so that they don't have to take them back. The Germans have said they need evidence in order to be able to try them before they will take fighters back. And of course, that's an almost impossibly high standard for all of the Germans or dual citizens who may have joined ISIS. The Canadians have acknowledged that they don't know whether their system has the capability, the sophistication to deal with this kind of question, despite the fact the world has known for 5 years that ISIS has been luring, seducing fighters from more than 80 countries, it has made very little in the way of preparation for what to do if ISIS was actually defeated. A French diplomat told me that even if they tried to take back just the women who are in the Al-Hol camp, that the women could go before a magistrate in France and claim that she was abducted, that she did not want to leave the Syria, and she would automatically be freed. And again, do you want these people walking the streets? So it's a really complicated issue. And one of the issues, too, is not just the current generation of fighters or females in prison or in al-Hol camp. The majority of people who surrendered or were captured in the final months of the Islamic State were children. And at al-Hol, 65% of those 7,300 are under the age of 12. A quarter of them are under the age of 5. They were born under the Islamic State's rule. And we're talking about a second generation. They were brought up in under the rigorous standards of the Islamic State. And there are 11,000, according to the UN, between the ages of 6 and 18, who have had no exposure to any form of education in the last 5 years, in other words, under ISIS rule. And how do you ensure that they don't become the next generation? We've now seen three different generations of fighters. There was the first generation that fought in Afghanistan in the 1980s. You had a second generation represented by Al-Qaeda and the host of kind of spin-off Sunni groups, and the third generation now represented by ISIS. And one of the interesting trends is that with each generation, mobilizing takes half the time of the previous generation. With each generation, there is a wider range of countries. The first generation was recruited largely from the Gulf states. The second generation was recruited largely from the Arab world, North Africa, the Middle East, the Levant, the Gulf. The ISIS generation, as we now know, was recruited from five continents globally. So we're dealing with a problem that gets bigger with every generation. So the focus should be just as much on what to do with these children as what to do with the fighters and their wives.
Ali Soufan, in your writing as well, you've written about the children of terrorist fighters. If I was to take Robin's formulation of a first, second, and third generation, the children of the second generation are not a very promising crew if you want to send them to middle school somewhere in the world. It sounds like they are already well steeped in a way of life that could potentially make them dangerous. But yet, you know, they can't be imprisoned, they can't be killed. Can they be rehabilitated?
ISIS especially always thought of the children as one of the most important assets that they have. They always thought about the future of the caliphate. And it is a complicated situation. However, we cannot just sit on it and talk about the problem. I think what we need to do, especially with people who are from Western states and connected to Western states, we need to start thinking outside the box and developing a strategy to deal with it. I don't know if there are law enforcement and intelligence services from the countries that's affected, that they have citizens over in al-Hol or in foreign fighters and other prisons in Iraq and Syria. I don't know if they are there talking to their people, figuring out what happened, figuring out how to build cases. That's what we used to do in the FBI. You build a case. You start with evidence that you probably recovered from the field, from the front lines, from their bases. You look into computer drives. You start flipping people and getting statements from individuals. You build cases about people who you can prove in a court of law that they committed crimes, but also you have to legislate to deal with this threat. You need to issue different laws in Europe, like they did, for example, about the movement between European states, especially after the Paris attack. These guys, they have contacts back home. They have communities who basically going to be more sympathetic to them. We cannot make living martyrs out of them. We need to basically treat them according to our laws. Our laws and every European and Western laws is way stronger than them. My fear that if we don't do anything, my fear if we just bury our head in the sand, they're going to be way more dangerous than the generations that Robin spoke about. They are more radicalized. They don't know anything except this situation. They're going to be further radicalized. And I can guarantee that the Kurds or the Iraqis or whoever is going to be controlling the whole or other camps are not going to be, they're not going to keep them there. Many of these people are also Syrian and Iraqis. And I think the Iraqi government, now Syria is still in the middle of civil war, but the Iraqi government need to figure out how to reintegrate them in the social fabric of Iraq. I mean, and it's very difficult because they were involved with families and tribes and fighters who committed massacres against Shia and against Yazidis and against Christians. But this is where a national, some kind of like a tribal leadership with the Iraqi government need to take a place in order to figure out how to weave them again into the social fabric of Iraq. If we don't do that, that is going to create a bigger problem down the road, and it's going to create ISIS on steroids down the road. We've seen what happened during Maliki. That might happen again. So I agree with Robin that it's not only rehabilitation. I agree with the complexity of prosecution, but I think we can start in doing something. The European countries can start in doing something. But also, I think we need to think about, weaving those people back into their villages, into their towns. And there are many. There is a few thousand Iraqi families that requested to be taken back to Iraq. And I think they are taking them 150 at a time to Iraq. So let's see what's going to happen. But feeling of alienation, feeling of dehumanization for these people after they return might help ISIS in recruiting the second generation. Those kids can still be dealt with at this stage in trying to hopefully creating a better future for them. But if we keep them where they are, we can guarantee something. There is no better future going to be for them. And we're going to be fighting them with our children and our children's children.
Robin Wright, in your encounters with these prisoners, were there moments in the interview where they seemed like people appropriately oriented toward the time and space, their age, and then the conversation takes a turn where you realize they haven't changed at all, or they're not defeated, or they're still defiant?
It's hard to create a stereotype for a wide diversity of whether nationalities or age groups or just the types of people who ended up being recruited by ISIS. There are many different reasons and many different types of individuals. Some of those I talked to mentioned that ISIS made some mistakes, that ISIS may have been too extreme. I talked to a Moroccan who was one of the emirs of morality, and he acknowledged seeing somewhere, he thought, between 10 and 15 stonings of women who'd been charged for adultery, where women are buried in the ground and men gather and throw stones at her head until she dies. He also was part of a group who put more than a dozen Yazidi women in a cage, covered them in gasoline, and set them on fire. And of course, they all died. And he acknowledged there were some mistakes. But all of those I talked to, whether it was among the injured in the hospital I visited, holding just hundreds of foreign fighters, or in the prison, they still believed in the idea of ISIS or an Islamic State or ruled under Islamic law. And that included the American I met from Chicago. Again, though there were their roles within ISIS varied widely. As the prison warden said to me, as one was describing a Turk, that no, he was just a cook and he hadn't done anything, and he used to make pizza in Istanbul, and he'd been lured to ISIS because he was a practicing Muslim and he just served to make food for the ISIS fighters. And the prison warden kept saying, he's a liar, he's a liar. And afterwards he said, they're all lying, either to themselves or to us. And I think there are a lot of them are trying to figure out, you know, what their futures are. They've been captured. They have no representation. And I think we have to remember that the militia in Syria that captured them is just that. It's a militia. It's not a state. It doesn't have formal prisons recognized by the Syrian government. It doesn't have the resources to pay for these people. One of the problems at the hospital was that the head of the hospital said they had to defer payment of the Syrian fighters who had defeated ISIS, the militia fighters, in order to buy food for the ISIS prisoners. That the current system is not sustainable financially or physically. And that brings up one other point, and that is, what happens if these people are not taken back and the Kurdish-led militia, backed by the United States and an international coalition, is stuck with them? And are we talking about years, decades of holding these people? What happens within the camp where there, you know, where there are not formal schools to educate these kids? What happens to the women? Who's going to pay for the food? Nobody in the international community wants to pay to sustain to provide for the basics for ISIS believers, ISIS followers, particularly those who are challenging the system. And if there are not proper prisons, is there the danger, as Ali knows so well, of prison raids? That's how ISIS originally manned its genesis in 2012 and 2013, when there were 7 prison breaks in Iraq, including one at the infamous Abu Ghraib, where at each facility, hundreds of ISIS sympathizers or extremist militants were liberated, and they joined ISIS ranks and created the first corps of fighters. There is that great fear now that the prisons, a different set of prisons now in northeast Syria, will be raided by the underground cells of ISIS. We know that there are thousands of them who have not been captured. And does that then recreate ISIS 2.0 or a different incarnation of Sunni extremism? There are so many dangers out there that the world simply isn't paying attention to because they believe the physical caliphate has evaporated.
Ali Soufan, one of the centers for demobilized ISIS fighters is in the U.S.-backed Kurdish territory in northern Iraq, in Tal Maruf. And there's international money heading to that place. But earlier in our conversation, you said, oh, don't send them to the Kurds. That's not really a solution. Why'd you say that?
I said it's not a solution to keep them with the Kurds for the same reasons that Robin just explained. The Kurds are a militia, and there is some idea among the Europeans that maybe we can just pay the Kurds to handle this problem or even to prosecute these people. The Kurds are not equipped to be those guys are fighters. They are not prison wardens. They are not judges. They are not prosecutors and defense lawyers. They are militia who fought ISIS, and they caught a lot of these ISIS guys in the field, and they put them in prisons or in camps. So we need to, this is not a solution. This is kind of like kicking the can down the road. If the international community doesn't take this seriously, if these countries don't pay attention to this, I think the international system will pay dearly for that down the road, because this is going to be a big problem, and it's not going away unless we create the conditions to take it away. Now, not tomorrow, now.
One of the things that's really interesting about the question on can Iraq take some of these ISIS fighters, and whether it's and some of the families, whether it's putting the families in displaced persons camps or tries the fighters. Iraq already had more than 20,000 ISIS that it captured. There were 31,000 Iraqis in Syria. Iraq has informally said it'll take them back, but as Ali pointed out, only 150 at a time. We're talking about 31,000, and there are still debates within the Iraqi government about what should they do with them? Under what terms should they take them? And with what kind of international support? So we're not talking about a solution just to the Iraqi part of the ISIS problem in Syria. We're talking about Iraq would have over 50,000 if it took them all back. And considering where Iraq is with, it still is trying, I mean, I went to West Mosul, which was the largest city held by ISIS, and it's totally devastated. Iraq has so much reconstruction to do before it can begin to absorb, house, and create jobs and schools for its own people, and using its resources to try to deal with ISIS will be an additional drain. So again, we're talking about a problem that no one wants to take responsibility for, and that almost guarantees we're going to see, in some form, this problem reemerge in a deadly way, a threat to the international community, as well as to all of our interests in the Middle East down the road.
We've been hearing from Ali Soufan and Robin Wright on the future of ISIS after losing its last bit of territory in Syria. After the break, join us for the second half of the conversation with Ray Suarez. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It's produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Ali Soufan, a former FBI special agent and author of the book The Autonomy of Terror. He's joined by Robin Wright, writer for The New Yorker and fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Along with the very real problem that must be solved about what to do with people who've been taken off the battlefield and their families, is the real problem of assessing, understanding, and countering the continuing danger from an ISIS that no longer has a state. If we were to ask, if we were to begin that part of the program by asking, where is ISIS now? We saw with the Easter bombings, just a few short weeks after the final towns and countryside that ISIS held fell, then came the Easter bombings in Sri Lanka. What is the nature of the continuing danger? Where is ISIS? Where are the fighters? Where do they get their money? Where do they get their material and their weapons and their logistical support? As we assess what the danger remains in the future, how do we assess where ISIS is as an organization right now, Ali?
I think the factors that allowed ISIS to exist in the first time still exists. ISIS was defeated in the battlefield, and this is a huge success. However, the narrative, the idea, the ideology behind ISIS, the social and political and economic factors that allowed the so-called Islamic State to be still there. ISIS today, I believe, is where Al-Qaeda was after they were kicked out from Afghanistan in the aftermath of 9/11. ISIS today is taking advantage of existing conflicts. We've seen that in the Sahel. We've seen that in with Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. We've seen it in a very small, limited way in Yemen, but also in Pakistan, Afghanistan, in southern Philippines. They are taking advantage of these conflicts to establish provinces. Sana'a, for example, is another example in Egypt. But this is where Al-Qaeda, this is what Al-Qaeda did after 9/11. Al-Qaeda switched from being an organization that only deal with people who gave bay'ah and they have a strong structure and command and control to a message. And ISIS now is trying to be a message. And this message have a lot of people who still adhere to its principles and to the belief, both in prison camps, in refugee camps, and around the world, as we've seen in Sri Lanka recently. And this is very dangerous. ISIS also, at the same time, was able to take away most of the money that they have. So they smuggled the money to safe locations, and ISIS still have really good coffers, not as much as they used to have when they have a physical estate, but they are still very rich. Also, they have people who are technically savvy in using social media and using the internet and using different platforms to communicate their message to a wider audience. So in order to really defeat ISIS, we have to defeat the ideology and the narrative that allowed it to exist in the first place. And unfortunately, the show that we're doing today, what you heard from Robin and what your audience heard throughout this show, shows that the international community is not doing what needs to be done in order to prevent an ISIS 2.0 or 3.0 of happening.
Robin Wright, do you agree? Is Brussels not talking to Tunis and Tunis not talking to Rabat and Rabat not talking to Washington? How come there is no concerted international effort to shut off the money, to shut off the personnel, to stop the same syndrome from happening again?
Oh, there is an extraordinary attempt to do all of those things, in some ways better than we've ever done before. The United States created a coalition of more than 70 countries and a few international organizations that coordinate through whether it's Interpol, just among themselves. There is a database, for example, that has been created that tries to track those people who joined. But I think the problem is in some ways is shifting. First of all, you have the leader of ISIS is still out there someplace. Abu Bakr Baghdadi, who was once in custody of U.S. troops in 2004 in Iraq, he has managed to escape, as have other senior leaders. They're widely believed to be somewhere along the Iraq-Syrian border, but they have proved very elusive. And he managed to get a message out after the collapse of his Islamic State. And then there's the secondary problem of what does the international community now do in creating a de-radicalization program, or what the new buzzword is, disengagement. We may not be able to de-radicalize people, to separate them from their beliefs, their desire to live under an Islamic State, but how do you disengage them from participating or doing things that are active with particularly the Sunni extremist movements like Al-Qaeda and ISIS? And that both of those are very hard. De-radicalization has proven to be the most insoluble challenge that the international community has faced. There are rehabilitation programs in Saudi Arabia, very ambitious, and to some degree a bit successful, but they have had hundreds who return to extremism, despite the fact they are offered, whether it's cars or perks for their family. In one case, I went to interview former Al-Qaeda operatives who'd been in Gitmo, went through the Saudi rehabilitation program and had been freed, and they had been given all kinds of things, and yet they were still believers in a in hardline ideology and still bored in their current lives. They were perhaps not going to go back to jihad because it was financially or logistically difficult. Certainly they're being monitored. But the bigger question is, when you get the huge numbers we're now seeing, how do you try to separate them from whatever they believe, at least not engaging in deadly activities? And so there are stages of rehabilitation, and you don't just do it overnight or in 1 year. This is a longstanding operation or challenge for people who have been committed for many years now and who have little to fall back on. What kind of lives are any of these people going to live, even if they were free again? The stigma they will carry with them for the rest of their lives. And so it's pulling together an extraordinary array of threads to create a fabric that will provide an alternative vision for a lot of these people, or alternative way of life, whatever they continue to believe.
You said earlier that ISIS is still out there as an idea, Ali Soufan. And when ISIS was growing as a state, sort of cannibalizing large parts of eastern Syria and western Iraq to become a sort of binational, supranational state, intelligence sources told me that part of the attraction was that it was now just a place and not just an idea, that it had a revenue stream, that it had a leadership structure. Well, now that it's not a place, why does the attraction remain as powerful? And I know you use the parallel of Al-Qaeda after the fall of Afghanistan. What's the appeal? What's the value proposition for an unhappy young man somewhere in the world, or even one that's managed to get an education or comes from an upper middle class family?
Well, ISIS give them a new alternative to their reality. ISIS give them the idea that they are fighting for God. They are fighting for what God wants, that his Sharia to be established on earth, for Muslims to have their own state. And I think this is a very appealing idea to so many people around the world, regardless to their economic situation. And I think, unfortunately, everything that, earlier with what we're doing against ISIS that Robin mentioned, like the coalition against ISIS, the United Nations security resolutions on ISIS and the foreign fighters, unfortunately, all these things are to target the physical caliphate. I don't think now there is agreement among the coalition members on what to do next. What is the mission of the coalition after the defeat of the physical caliphate? There is no agreement, for example, in the international community as to who's considered terrorist and who's not considered terrorist, and what kind of data, information we need to share with each other. Even travel data, for example, you have countries like Egypt who will say, we need to include all the Muslim Brotherhood subject that we have as terrorism, or we're not going to be part of that program. So there's a lot of confusion so far among partners. The United States trying to work with the European communities, European nations, our allies in Europe, to take their citizens back. There's a problem between how the European view their role down the road and why the United States view their role to be down the road. So there's a lot of issues now that is preventing us from targeting the ideology and targeting the narrative. And unfortunately, we're not good in doing that. I mean, look at Al-Qaeda, for example. Since 2001, Al-Qaeda now, 10 times bigger as an organization as it used to be before. They used to have a few hundred people in Afghanistan, and now they have thousands across the Muslim world. Yes, they are focusing locally at this stage, but you have to keep in mind that at any time, the dynamics of the Salafi Jihadi movement might change, and they might start focusing internationally. Tactically, we are very successful. There is no battle that we cannot win. However, all our tactical successes can lead into a strategic failure if you don't target the incubating factors that fed that threat in the first place. And unfortunately, today we're not. Unfortunately, a lot of people in the international community talk about these kind of things, but beyond the talk, beyond the statements on paper, I don't believe that we have what need to be in order to tackle the problems, not only in Al-Hol and the other camps that we have in Iraq and Syria, but also internationally with the ideology and with this virtual caliphate that started to unfold in front of our very own eyes.
That's a pretty serious indictment and a thorough one. Robin, do you agree with that, that the attraction of being blown to pieces for a cause is still greater than that of being talked out of it, of being deterred, of being retracted in some other way?
Look, I think it's natural among human beings in general to want to believe in something, to want to feel that you're protected and supported and nurtured by a community, by a religion, by a political system. And one of the challenges today for many in the Islamic world is finding the leadership, the idea, ideology, the support. And there are an awful lot of dictators out there who don't offer much of an alternative either. I do think Ali is right in terms of our tactical success, that U.S. airstrikes were decisive in destroying many of the ISIS headquarters, barracks, arms depots, economic warehouses, facilities, that we militarily were incredibly effective at a cost of, at one point it was averaging over $13 million a day. And the problem is no one wants to spend that kind of money to deal with the human problem. We know how to destroy. We don't know how to create alternatives. We don't know how to create, whether it's helping nations rebuild. We didn't do a great job in Afghanistan or Iraq. And, you know, trying to figure out the human dimension of this problem. We are effective kinetically, but not when it comes to the human dimension. And I think that is where we will be most vulnerable for the foreseeable future.
In a post-territory ISIS, Ali, does it matter who the leader is? I mean, as Robin mentioned earlier, al-Baghdadi has reemerged on tape, exhorting his followers and claiming new provinces for the Islamic State. If we get Baghdadi, is just somebody going to take his place? And it doesn't really matter who the CEO is at any time or place.
I think when it comes to ISIS, yes, leadership matters, because most of the number two people in ISIS were killed. You know, the worst job you can do in ISIS was being the number two, because you've been targeted by U.S. almost immediately. In a few months, and you're out. Abu Ayman al-Iraqi, Haji Bakr, Abu Muslim Turkmani, you can go down the list. Everyone who was number two is gone. So most of the leadership that the folks in ISIS knew about does not exist. So al-Baghdadi is important. Because the bay'ah is to al-Baghdadi as a caliph, and he's gone, a lot of people not going to know who is that person that ISIS is going to appoint. This is very unlike al-Qaeda, for example, where the death of Osama bin Laden did not affect the organization as much, because a lot of the leaders of al-Qaeda continue to exist until today. The number two was Ayman Zawahiri, who is currently the leader of al-Qaeda. Saif al-Adl is still alive. Abu Muhammad al-Masri is still alive. You know, those guys are members of the Shura Council of al-Qaeda. You know, Abu al-Khair was just killed recently in Syria last year, I believe, in Idlib. So al-Qaeda continued to have that, you know, first-tier leadership that is helping to develop the second-tier leadership, as we've seen with Hamza bin Laden, who is married to the number two of al-Qaeda today, to the daughter of the number two of al-Qaeda today, Abu Muhammad al-Masri. In ISIS, the situation is different. And if there is no caliph, and if there is no bay'ah towards an individual, I think many of these Salafi jihadis might go to form either their own thing, or in some places, as we start seeing in Yemen, for example, maybe joining back into al-Qaeda. So I think the death of Baghdadi will be more important than, for example, the death of Osama bin Laden and its impact on al-Qaeda.
Robin, do you agree?
I suspect so. I do think that there's a broader issue that has emerged that we don't pay enough attention to, and that is within the Sunni world, there is this vacuum at the moment. In years past, you had Nasserism that came out of Egypt or Baathism that came out of Syria and Iraq, that there isn't an idea that offers a direction for Sunnis who constitute 85% of the world's more than 1.3 billion Muslims. And that has by default left the likes of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other extremist movements, smaller but often as deadly, out there as, you know, the only ones that offer an alternative. The Arab world particularly has very little leadership. In Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is trying to create a leadership role for him in the kingdom, in the Gulf, and in the wider Arab world. But of course, he is widely perceived as an ambitious and in some ways aggressive leader who's launched a war against Yemen and has been linked publicly to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who butchered and dismembered in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. So that in the past, it was the Shiites who were looking for leadership. They were, in places like Lebanon and elsewhere in the region, the marginalized, unrepresented sector of the Islamic world. Since the Iranian Revolution, the world's largest Shiite country, since the creation of Hezbollah in Lebanon, you've seen the Shiites mobilize in a way that have created new leaders, ideas, organizations, armed forces that give them a sense of direction. In contrast, the Sunnis have been groping for some place to look in this, you know, we saw the Arab Spring when the young were trying to throw off dictators but couldn't create an alternative. And it's interesting that in Tunisia, you saw the very first uprising in 2011, ousted a president who'd been in power more than two decades in a mere 30 days. And yet it contributed one of the two largest communities to ISIS in the thousands. And so that even though they ousted authoritarian rule, there's a sense that all the needs or the human, economic, whatever, ideological, were not met even after the uprising. And I think so there's a much bigger phenomena out there to deal with. It's not just whether ISIS or Al-Qaeda still exist, whether Osama bin Laden or his successor or ISIS Abu Bakr Baghdadi still are alive and functioning. It's really what is the alternative idea that helps redirect the energy and the sense of hopelessness among a lot of Muslims.
In a sense, if I understand you, a part of the source of continuing discontentment is the failure of so many of these states. But even when there's change in them, it's not satisfying that need. It's not scratching that itch. You still have this yearning for something that people haven't found yet. Is that fair?
There is a yearning that they haven't found, but also one of the ironies of democratic openings is that it allows people to vent in ways they weren't allowed to under autocratic rule. And so in Tunisia, which is now the most democratic of the 22 or 3 Arab countries, you see, the attacks in Sousse and in Tunis, the recruitment, successful recruitment of thousands to join ISIS, whether it's in Libya or in Syria or Iraq. And there are genuine security issues still in Little Tunisia, which should trouble us all because it became the model for how you make a transition. And transitions and openings also allow those who are the fundamentalists or the militants to gain voice and freedom of movement and freedom of speech as well. So this is a real issue during the transition, which I think the Arab world, the Middle East in general, is going to see play out for potentially decades to come.
You know, Ali, in past years, I've been on the streets of Casablanca, Algiers, Tunis, Cairo, even Dar es Salaam and Zanzibar. And one thing that all those very different places have in common is that there's so many young men with nothing to do. It always has struck me, as bad news has come from these places at various times, that's just a pile of nice dry tinder. A lot of young guys with nothing to do, and a government that's watching them all the time, in some cases, anyway. Is state failure, I mean, if we go through this huge effort that both of you have been talking about throughout the hour to defeat these networks, is it going to be all for naught if states continue to fail their citizens?
Look, what you just described is basically a perfect description of a workshop, a devil's workshop. I mean, yes, absolutely. When you have all these people who have no jobs, have no hope, have no future, they are an easy target for somebody to recruit them for terrorist activities or for whatever. You know, in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in general, later the Salafi Jihadi movement, understood something that we did not understand in the West, understood that there is nothing called a state in these countries if there is no dictators on top. So what is Libya without Gaddafi? What is Iraq without Saddam? It's, you know, the institutions that make a state in the West, the civil institutions, law and the non-corrupt legislation, legal system and law enforcement and all these things don't exist. So that identity was the Iraqi identity or the Libyan identity or the Syrian identity is connected to the dictatorship on top. And if that dictatorship is not there, I think the society is going to separate into, ethnic, sectarian. In Libya, we see tribal divisions between East and West. In Iraq, Arab Shia, Arab Sunni, Kurds, and so forth. In Syria, Alawite and Sunnis and people from urban areas versus people from rural areas. And everybody looks at the situation differently. And I think Al-Qaeda knew that this is a situation. And bin Laden, just before the Navy SEALs bullet took him out, he gave instruction to start focusing locally, build the relationship with these different elements in different countries and make them, ordering his people, don't focus on America as much as try to prevent somebody else from filling the vacuum in places like Yemen or in Libya or in any other of the Arab Spring places. Because whoever is going to fill the vacuum is going to be the new agent for the Americans. And this is what created a lot of chaos. So I think there is a significant failure in the Arab world and the Muslim world, the state failure.
Well, a fascinating and worrying conversation. Thanks a lot to you both. Robin Wright, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Ray.
Ali Soufan, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent and author of the book The Anatomy of Terror. He's joined by Robin Wright, writer for The New Yorker and fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. This program was moderated by my co-host, Ray Suarez. On the next episode of World Affairs.
Clearly, citizens are more disillusioned with their governments, they're more disillusioned with political parties and the mainstream channels of political representation. So they feel they're being forced out onto the street because governments simply aren't responsive to their demands.
Next on World Affairs, we'll consider how and when protest leads to lasting change. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. Our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.